The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Your Honor, every one of these letters is addressed to Santa Claus. The post office has delivered them. Therefore, the Post Office Department, a branch of the federal government, recognizes this man, Kris Kringle, to be the one and only Santa Claus.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it. Case dismissed.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's such a classic movie, right? 1947, that version of Miracle on 34th Street, the pinnacle courtroom scene that determined Kris Kringle's fate. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. I'm Drew Mariani. Stopping by in just a second, Father Richard Simon. And we thought today we'd take a look at the real Saint Nick. And, you know, I'm from the East Coast initially. Born and raised outside of the Philadelphia area. And I remember when my wife and I moved to Wisconsin to join Relevant Radio. Their network headquarters at the time was stationed in Green Bay. They're now, of course, down in Chicago. Maggie, I never shared this story with you, but my very first encounter with St. Nick was this, you know. I come here, I think I start broadcasting with the network in 04 or 05, and we had young kids. They were all in grade school at the time. And the kids came home from school and they were all upset. And we said, what's the matter? Well, St. Nick didn't come for us. We're like, why would St. Nick come for you? I mean, I knew nothing about St. Nick. But apparently, you know, and this is common, I think, for a lot of states in the Union, but not every one of them. Back on the East Coast, we never celebrated St. Nick's Day. And he didn't put a shoe out or a stocking. There was no chocolates, as Father Rocky had just talked about in his little piece there on St. Nick. And my wife felt so guilty. As a mother, she felt so bad that she ran out, I think, tried to get him something and surprise him. Oh, he must have been late. I'd love to hear from you, Mag, too, just your St. Nick experience. I mean, is it something you grew up with? Has it always been that way for you? Because I know you're from Wisconsin, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it is more common culturally here. My mom, my sweet mother, as you could imagine, she always went to Hughes chocolates in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Did you ever have Hughes?
I never have, no.
Oh my gosh, nope. So good. She would always go and get Hughes chocolates. She would wait in line and come home. And usually on the Feast of St. Nick, we'd wake up and the stockings that we hung near the fireplace, she would put some chocolates and candy canes and things in it, you know. And sometimes like a little trinket, like a yo-yo or a gift. Yeah.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great tradition. I love it. And what a great way to teach your kids about the saints. In fact, coming up, Father Simon will probably give us a little more background. But St. Nicholas, of course, was a great saint. He was known for his generosity, even saving women from sexual slavery by giving them dowries for money. And it became well known. And somehow over the centuries, that morphed into what we have today as Santa Claus. I didn't realize this, but Catholic Vote, and I think this is where I saw this, they actually said that St. Nick is the patron of sex trafficking victims. I would not have thought that he would have been the patron of sex trafficking victims, but I guess it makes sense since he did so much to rescue them. For a little more historical context on who St. Nick is, listen to this.
Far from a silly, tubby cartoon character, St. Nicholas of Myra was a serious, prayerful man, a deeply loving bishop, and, most strikingly of all, a gallant hero to maidens in distress. In fact, it's something he did while still a young man that makes him an especially timely saint for us today, something that you could say makes him a patron saint of sex trafficking victims. It all started when Nicholas's wealthy parents died and left him a large inheritance. As a member of the clergy who lived an unusually disciplined life of fasting and personal poverty, Nicholas had no use for the money and immediately began looking for ways to use it for the good of his neighbor. One of the first opportunities he took was the case of a poor man and his three daughters. The father was under a time constraint. If he couldn't scratch together enough money for his daughter's well-being, they would be forced into prostitution. Nicholas decided he would intervene, but devised a dashing plan to keep it secret. He would slip out at night and provide an income to the father and his daughters in the form of sacks of gold, which Nicholas threw deftly through the windows and chimney of their house. To this day, especially in the East, icons of an athletic St. Nicholas sprinting by this poor family's house to slip them their gold are common, and they look a lot more like images of a valiant, handsome young Robin Hood than of a doting old man. And according to legend, this manful, courageous, and heroic character did not decrease with age. Years later, he made a stir by getting into a physical altercation with a leading heretic in the middle of a church council. So St. Nicholas Day is a good day to remember that saints like Nicholas aren't only the tame, easygoing stuff of picture books. As the true St. Nicholas reminds us, what the Catholic Church offers the world is heroes. And as victims, from those three young sisters to today's trafficking victims, would tell you, that's just what the world needs.
Amen to that. Amen to that. So today, the great feast of St. Nicholas, and it's good to talk about him. I do want to just give a quick cautionary tale. Every year, I invite Father Richard Simon to stop by, and we talk about something else because, you know, I want to talk about the man who lived at the North Pole. But again, I just want to caution you. I don't think your children should be listening to this. You know, and I'm going to leave it up to your discretion if you want to continue listening to that or not. But I got to talking about how St. Nicholas is the basis for our modern day Santa Claus, right? And if you'd come from a distant galaxy and you beamed down to Earth, specifically here in the United States, and you went to a shopping mall and you saw this guy wearing a red suit with a white beard, you'd have no idea who this guy was or how he was connected to a great saint that lived 1,700 years ago. And that's the problem some have today with, you know, with this mythical man who comes on December 25th or that night to bring presents, because he's become a totally secular symbol. You know, here on the birth of Christ, you know, it has become, you know, a day oriented around a great myth. Now, for some reason, there are school administrators today, I should say, who are able to make a connection, and some have banned Santa from the classrooms, but he has really become the secular equivalent of what might be called the Santa God. You know, I want this, so can you deliver it to me? Now, I know you might say, oh, come on, Drew, you're being a Scrooge, bah humbug. I loved Santa as a kid. I mean, I went crazy. If I heard sleigh bells jingling or I saw him in a store window, I'd go crazy. I loved Santa Claus. One of the saddest days of my life was when you know, the reality of who he was came to light. And I want to be careful about what I say, but let me welcome, before I put my foot in my mouth, Father Richard Simon. He's much more delicate at addressing these issues. And he, one of my colleagues here, I hear him every day right before I come on the air. Father, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Delicate. Yes. Beg your pardon. It's good to caution the children to go away before I'm on the air.
That's so true. Right. You and I talk about this every year, and I want to ruin Christmas for anyone, but I do think this is worthy of a discussion, just where we are today. But let me throw it to you. You heard what I said. I love your thoughts.
Yeah.
You're not a great fan of Santa, if I remember correctly.
Oh, I am a great fan of the whole schmear, but I really believe it's wrong to lie to children. I don't know if you ever heard me talk about Corrie Ten Boom. She was a great Dutch Reformed Church, a great heroine rescuing people who were, you know, in the Second World War, rescuing Jews from the Nazis, for which she went to a concentration camp. And she tells a story about when she was a little girl and she asked her father about, I mean, she must have been six or seven, asked her father about sex. She'd heard girls talking in the play lot. And he didn't say anything. And when the train stopped, he was going into town to get supplies for his watch supply business or watch repair business. He said, Corrie, would you pick up my tools bag? And she tried and said, Papa, it's too heavy to lift. He says, yes, there are certain things that are too heavy for you to bear now, but when it's time, I'll tell you about them. You know, he didn't lie to her. He didn't give her stories about the stork and the cabbage patch. And I think that's one way to approach it. But there comes a point where some kid hears in school, there's no Santa Claus. And it becomes, I remember when I was trying to deal as a 6-year-old with there's no Santa Claus, It was almost theological. And, you know, we tell our kids there's an Easter Bunny, there's a Tooth Fairy, there's a Santa Claus, and there's God. Well, if we're lying about the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, well, maybe we're lying about God. And I think we Catholics have a wonderful opportunity to tell the truth, to just say, you know, we know the real Santa Claus. He was St. Nicholas, Santa Claus. That's Saint and Claus together. The Claus was the short form for Nicholas in German. And we know the truth. That he lives in heaven with God. It's really Jesus who gives us the ability to give you presents. But, you know, the guy at the North Pole, it's fun to pretend. So you can pretend. You know, you can have the fun with the elves and all that stuff. But we know the truth, that he's in heaven with God. There's a real Santa Claus, and he prays for us. Yeah, there is a Santa Claus. His real name is St. Nicholas, and we know it because we're Catholics.
Yeah, I had a friend, a colleague, I should say. I worked with this woman years ago. And she shared with me the story of having this unbelievable, you know, love for Santa, as I did as a young boy. And then she asked her parents one day about it. And you know what her first question was, Father, when the father told her, when her father or mother told her the truth? She goes, well, then, is there a God, too? Because, I mean, she immediately went to question the reality of God. If there's this mythical figure that comes and gives you everything you ask for. Well, I've never met God. I haven't seen him either, but you told me that he exists. You know, so I think it challenges some people's faith.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know people who want their kids to believe the story about Santa Claus and the North Pole and the elves till they're 10, 11, 12, and that's nuts. You know, I really think that you shouldn't lie to children. It's wrong to lie to children. You don't have to tell them everything at once, but you shouldn't lie to kids.
So. But it is fun, too, just to take the other side of this thing. I mean, I knew how much I loved it as a kid. I was so disappointed later in life, but I mean, I was just, it's so much fun, and just watching the TV shows and the light, it's an enchanting time of year.
We should tell them that it's the other stuff is all for fun. It's based, but in a way, we have a way to preserve it. We can say it's based on a reality, that our the whole Santa Claus thing is based on a reality, so it isn't all just make-believe. But the make-believe part is fun, and enjoy it. You know, we make-believe with Star Wars and Star Trek and all that other stuff and all these other, and The Hobbit. And, you know, enjoy a life of mythology. Why not? It's fun. And we're lucky because we're Catholic and we know there's some truth to it.
You're right. My guest today, Father Richard Simon, if you want to join us, I only have him for a few minutes today. We'd love to hear from you. Your thoughts on how you broke the news or whether or not you celebrate the way we do. And again, just a cautionary tale. I would not suggest you have any young believers in Santa Claus, any children tuning in right now. So just, you know, maybe make sure you come back and listen to the podcast later or just usher them to another room. But the number here to get in is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can call in now and join the conversation. Father, you know, this is a recent you know, innovation too. I mean, this was not always the case.
Yeah.
I mean, in the old country, it was the Christ child who brought the gifts, right?
Yeah. It was Christ or the three kings. If you're in a Spanish or Italian, you know, Mediterranean context, it was the three kings. And Puerto Ricans always would put some straw or grass in a box under the bed for the camels. So on the Feast of the Three Kings, that's the big gift giving day. But you know,
nice
I was thinking about that when. Well, go on.
No, you go ahead, Father. I want to know what you're thinking.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, when your kids come up and tell you, Mom, or ask you, Mom, Dad, is there really a Santa Claus? And you have to say, well, no. We Catholics, we can say, yes, there is. There really is a Santa Claus. But let me explain the real story. You know, we can let them down easy with truth instead of just dashing their little hopes because we've lied to them all these years.
So is that what you told your parishioners? I mean, how did you deal with this at in Skokie when you were
there? Well, I never said that out loud in the pulpit because I remember I was alluding to it in the sermon, and a mother came up to me very upset that I had ruined her children's belief in Santa Claus. And, of course, they were trying to preserve that myth to the kids who were teenagers. And it was something they needed, that they needed more than the kids did. And I thought, that's really kind of sad. But they were wroth that I had alluded to it. So I avoided the topic unless someone asked.
I remembered going to my father one day because my father said, "Son, I'll always tell you the truth." And he always said that, you know, if you want to know something, you can always ask me. So I was probably, I don't know, second or third grade or something. And I remember my father sitting on the couch. I went over to him and said, "Hey, Dad," I said, you'll never lie to me. "No, of course not, son." I said, "You'll always tell me the truth." If I ask you, "Of course, son." And then I asked him the question, and he found himself in a between a rock and a hard place. What do you do? My mother was probably going to want to kill him because she was one of those people, Father, who wanted me to believe forever. You know, she's one of those who loved to perpetuate that particular myth. But it's hard. I mean, it really is. How do you suggest parents talk to the kids about it then? I mean, should they not teach this at all? Is it okay to do that in a special age, break it to them early? Because all the other kids in class are celebrating and enjoying it.
Yeah. Well, I would say when they ask, "Mom, Dad, is it really Santa Claus?" You don't have to ruin their mythologies until they ask. But the thing is that we who are Catholics, we get to say, "Yes, there is a Santa Claus, but we know his real name is Saint Nicholas. And let me tell you the real story about St. Nicholas." In other words, we get to say, "Yes, there's a Santa Claus," to the kids. Whereas pagans, they say, "No, it's just mythology." And I think that's so much more wonderful than, I wouldn't do it till they ask, then they ask pretty early, 5, 6, or you could start out with, we're going to celebrate the real feast of Santa Claus, the real Santa Claus Day, which is November the 6th. Why is that? Well, because he was a saint. That's good enough. They'll go for that.
Can you tell me what has happened?
So, Father, let's do this. Let's grab a quick call or two. I'll take a couple calls from around the country. I only have a few moments here. Our number's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Maggie, can I go to the phones? Lucia in Chicago? Hi, Lucia. Good afternoon.
Hi. Congratulations. Love your program. It's Thanks. An honor to hear you, to be on the radio. I just wanted to comment as far as how I broke the news to my son. I knew the question was going to come up sooner or later. So what I did, I took him to the library, and I showed him a book about St. Nicholas. And every time he will, I was expecting that he will ask me sooner or later, like I said. So every time he said, "Mom, but Santa Claus does not exist, but you told me he does exist." And I told him, "Well, do you remember the time we went to the library?" "Yes, Mom." "So you see, he does exist." And he goes, "But Ma, you leave the gifts. You left the gifts. The parents are the ones who put the gifts for us." And I told him, "Well, St. Nicholas left a job for us parents. And that is the reason why we are, helping out Santa Claus." Yes. And so he was happy with that answer.
I love it. Even Maggie was saying, "Father, in my ear," that's really sweet. I mean, that's a great way of doing it. I love that idea. Father, I'll let you chime in.
Exactly what I'm telling you. You did it the right way. You let him know the truth, and I think it's you can wait until they ask. But Lucia, you did it. You did some advanced work, which is a brilliant idea.
I love it. Well, Ken has got a question for you, Father. He's listening in Wisconsin. Hi, Ken. Good afternoon.
Hi, it's actually a comment. Told my kids, I was actually, before they got to the age that they were asking about Santa, I had them involved in Secret Santa for kids in their class. Anybody that needed something special for the year or anything like that, and that special attention. And by the time they got to the age of asking, I was like, "Yeah, well, this is actually St. Nicholas, and we're Secret Santas too."
Yeah. Cool.
And now you can be a Secret Santa for your younger siblings.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that we're so lucky. We get to let the kids down easy. Whereas the pagans, they got nothing.
Amen to that. All right. We'll take one final call for you, Father. It's Kathy in Southern California. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Father Simon.
Hi, Father. Love hearing from you always.
Yeah,
I was from a very large family, 7 kids. And so keeping that tradition going, it was a longstanding tradition in our family. My dad used to play Santa to other people's kids. Santa always came to our house before we went to bed. Somebody always came. We never knew who it was. One year, my parents, these are in the years when they had the old movie cameras that had the big trail of lights, the big ones that you held, and then you showed family movies afterwards. And they filmed Santa coming down the chimney and putting presents under our Christmas tree and going back up the chimney. Years after, we begged my mom and said, who was Santa? And she said, it was Santa. We told you. We never lied. Well, it turns out before she died, she told me, I've always told you it was Santa. Her mom's name was Santa. And she lived
often. Oh,
Santa,
isn't that lovely?
Came down our chimney.
Oh, that's funny.
It was a nice tradition, but we always celebrate the Christ child first, and we always have had Santa kneeling before the Christ child. That has been the biggest image,
lovely.
And we've always had him adoring the Christ child. So,
well, see, your mom didn't lie to you. She told you the truth.
That's awesome.
That's lovely.
Well, Father, I always enjoy hanging out with you. It's fun to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you. You and I are going to be together this Friday.
Yes, God willing.
You're coming to the Christmas party, right?
I'm coming. I'm planning. Yeah, I'll be there.
You'd make a good Santa Claus.
Well, I've done it before. I'm retired. I don't intend to do it again. Oh,
that's
dear.
So funny. Well, my wife and I think of you all often. Father Simon, we often at Relevant Radio at our Christmas party, we exchange gifts, or you can play this thing where you can get these gifts. And Father, you brought back from, was it Israel, these beautiful plates, you know? And my wife 1 year commented on it because somebody at our table had won this beautiful plate. I think it was of Lazarus' resurrection or Mary's flight into Egypt or something. The next year you came and gave one to my wife, and it's just stunning. A beautiful carving really is what it was. So, but we look forward to seeing you. We'll hang out.
I'm
okay?
Looking forward to it. Okay, we'll see you in a couple of days.
I'll
God
see you
willing.
On Friday.
All right.
Can't wait.
All right.
Thanks, Father.
God bless. Okay.
As Father Richard Simon, say a prayer for him. I do have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more. You know, quick time goes here. It goes so fast. A lot more to talk about. Actually, they found they've reconstructed St. Nick's face. If I have time, I'll tell you about that. Scientists, have used some new technology to see what the true St. Nick looked like. But we'll talk more. Stay with me. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
What your book talks about is the 200 million some Christians living in persecuted lands, what they're going through. What got you into this?
Yeah, I've always been interested in the plight of Christians in Muslim-majority countries like Pakistan. But my wife and I lived in Thailand for several years, from 2014 to 17. While we were there, we discovered a crisis we had no idea existed. Somewhere between 5,000 to 10,000 Pakistani Christians, many of whom are Catholic, who have fled persecution in Pakistan, which claims to be a tolerant nation that respects all religious beliefs, but in reality is very intolerant of Christians. There's a blasphemy law on the books there, which maybe some listeners are familiar with because of the famous case of Asia Bibi, who was accused of blasphemy and condemned to death. Thankfully, she was able to get out of the country after years in prison. So there's a lot of Pakistanis in Thailand who have fled there for similar reasons as Asia Bibi, and they are seeking refugee status, but they get stuck. So my book, The Persecuted, talks about both what kinds of horrific experiences these Christians experience in Pakistan, and then also what happens to them after they leave in places like Thailand.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was a little from my next guest. Casey Chalk's going to be joining me in just a moment. He wrote a book called The Persecuted, and it is quite revealing and quite telling. You know, I read a story, I guess it was last week, and I wanted to share it with you. It kind of touched me. We take for granted so much that we have here in the States. You know, I've had the great privilege of being able to travel to a lot of different nations where there's been poverty, a lot of suffering, even persecution. I read the story about an 8-year-old that was sold into marriage. You know, and the father had to do this. He had to sell his daughter for cash. So the father's going to get $2,000. The girl's name is Benazir. And he hasn't explained the details to her yet or what's even expected of her. She's too young to understand. She's only 8 years old. And it's traditional for families there in Afghanistan to pay a dowry to a bride's family for marriage. But it's extreme to arrange marriage for a child so young. And, of course, as we know, with the exodus of the U.S. from Afghanistan now, there's been economic collapse following the Taliban's takeover. And poor families are now forced to make really desperate choices. Children like Benazir and her siblings, they go to the streets. Parents send them begging on the streets. Or they collect garbage to heat their simple mud homes. They don't have enough money for food, enough money for wood. That's why they got to burn trash. Her father, I think the article I read said he was like 55 years older, but he looked so much older. His face was just worn, you know, with worry and just difficulty. And he was a day laborer, and the article I read said he hadn't found work in months. He had 8 children to feed. So what was he left with? His decision was to sell his daughter into marriage. And he says it was just a cold calculation. He says, we're 10 people in the family. I'm just trying to keep 10 alive by sacrificing one. I don't necessarily agree with it. I'm not in his shoes, you know, but they're starving to death. There was another story I read of a man over there who was a painter, right? And he had to sell his tools. He had to sell his paintbrushes and his buckets and everything else because he couldn't feed his family. Now what happens? How do you work? You don't. Afghanistan was a poor country before the Taliban took it over. And it was propped up by foreign aid. In fact, I think about 75% of public finances were supported by grants from the United States and from other countries. And when we left, when we withdrew, of course, you have these hardline Islamist Taliban members taking the government over. And a lot of that aid money was then frozen. Salaries dried up. Cash flow came to a halt. And now what do you have? You have a humanitarian crisis. And, you know, it looks like it's probably going to get worse. You know, right now, half the population of Afghanistan is facing hunger. 3.2 million children are suffering from malnutrition. And it goes on and on. It's tough. As I said, we take for granted all that we have here in the United States. And I hear stories like that. I tell you, it's to think about what they're going through. That's just the hardship of life. What about being a Christian? You know, here in our own country, we're concerned about restrictions being placed on religious freedom, right? I mean, I'm always decrying those, trying to ring the bell, raise awareness, whether it's from government mandates that healthcare workers, you know, participate in procedures maybe they object to, like abortion or sex reassignment procedures, or not being able to gather to worship because of a pandemic, you know, related restriction, whatever the cause. I mean, we've got to be vigilant. We've got to protect our liberties. It's easy to give them away. It's very difficult to get them back. But what we face here, just to give you a perspective, it's nothing like what our brothers and sisters in other countries face now on a daily basis. Right now, for instance, speaking of Afghanistan, I was reading a report that Christians there, they are facing perhaps the harshest of conditions as winter is hit. And they're in hiding. Christians are in hiding. They're facing winter right now, and it's difficult. The Taliban's out looking for them. They're trying to live wherever they can. But it's cold there. The conditions are harsh. Food is scarce. Many of them don't even have a place to stay. And there are reports that some Afghan families are so desperate, they're going to do anything to survive. As I said, you know, the one case of the father selling his child. But similar persecution is happening in other countries, too. Many of them are, of course, Muslim-majority countries. Pakistan, as you heard in the clip just a moment ago, is especially notorious for how it treats Christians. You know, police just ignore complaints of physical assaults, of kidnapping, of death threats, of rape. Even of the murder of Christians, they ignore it. I've talked about Aja Bibi at length. You know, she was thrown in jail for blasphemy, supposedly, allegedly blaspheming Allah. They got blasphemy laws, which allow anyone, I could accuse you of speaking ill of the Quran or Islam or Muhammad, you'll end up in jail for who knows how long. I've invited Casey Chalk to join me today. He's a contributing editor at the New Oxford Review, a senior contributor for the Federalist, and a frequent contributor to the American Conservative and Crisis magazine. And I saw a piece that he wrote recently, and in fact, I have his book, The Persecuted, True Stories of Courageous Christians Living Their Faith in Muslim Lands. It's a good read, and I would suggest you pick it up, make yourself aware, and then do what you can do to support agencies that are helping, but especially to pray for our brothers and sisters who are going through difficulties you may never experience. It is a delight to have you, Casey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me, Drew. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate your good work, and I hope your book does really well. You start off with the story of Aja Bibi, and that was a story I've covered for a long time. And, of course, you rely on the news reports for that story, but the rest of the book has stories for, of people who, you know personally. Let's talk about both of those. What's the latest with Aja? I mean, is she living in exile now in Canada? I mean, she faced some real hardship, but what happened with her is for those who might be familiar with the story, and then let's also talk about how you met some of the people you reported on.
Sure. The latest that I know about Aja Bibi is, might be best described as continuing to suffer from the trauma of her experiences. She has been repatriated to Canada. I believe the location is secret for the protection of herself and her family. But I also know that she's made a number of public comments regarding the same blasphemy law that was exploited to attack her and put her on death row, that would seem to suggest that she no longer feels as strongly or as negatively about the blasphemy law. And I was very surprised when I heard that earlier this year. I think it was at the beginning of 2021, and I wrote an article about that for the Catholic Herald. My guess is that what's probably explaining some of that tension within her has to do with trauma and the terrible experiences that she and many of the people that I met from Pakistan while I was working in Thailand, what they've gone through, because they truly are agonizing and terrible experiences that will leave lifelong damage.
Yeah, I could imagine. I would have PTSD after going through what she went through. So you decided to write this book. How did you meet some of the people that you chronicled and reported on and are now writing about? Bring us back in time and share with us a little bit of the reality of what so many Christians are now enduring.
Yeah, so in 2014, I moved with my wife and one-year-old daughter to Thailand. The local Catholic parish that we attended, which was both English language and Thai language, I immediately recognized a large South Asian population there, which I thought was very strange. I previously served in Afghanistan working with DOD, so I had some familiarity with that part of the world. So I approached some of these people that I discovered were Pakistanis, and I started asking questions. Why are you here? What happened to you in your home country? And the more that I asked and started writing about this for various Catholic and conservative publications, the more just amazed I was at the experiences that these people had in Pakistan. For a long time, going back 10, 15 years, these people had been suffering all manner of different persecutions. The Persecuted, my book, talks about a number of these Pakistani families who fled the same kind of persecution and suffering that Aja Bibi encountered and that you discussed at the beginning of your radio program. So things like harassment, loss of access to jobs, physical assault, threatening to abduct men's wives or children. In one case, one gentleman, Michael D'Souza, his sister-in-law actually was forcibly abducted by Muslims and married off to a mullah and was never heard from again.
Horrible. That is unbelievable. I mean, that is really unbelievable. I can't imagine that. What would you do as a husband, or what would you do if that was your sister or your daughter? I mean, absolutely horrific. But that's the reality of what goes on. I mean, we live in the United States, and so often, and I often say this, we only get our national news. It's all people watch. You might get a spattering of some international news, but to really understand what's going on. Pakistan, when you live there, and I know you've been to Afghanistan as well, what are conditions like for Christians who live there? I mean, you can't, I'm assuming, publicly profess your faith. It's got in secret. How do they worship? What goes on for Christians?
Well, in Afghanistan, yes. Worship is all practically underground. Islam is the official religion, and I believe no other religions are really allowed in the country. So all of the missionary activity that happened in Afghanistan while there was a large U.S. and NATO presence, that was all of that was done covertly in order to convert various Muslims to the faith. And I know a lot of them have been evacuated since U.S. forces and Western forces left earlier this year. In Pakistan, it's a little bit of a different story. The Christian community there is actually very ancient and venerable. It goes back to 7th, 8th century. Many of the Christians who are practicing their faith there openly in churches, evangelicals, Catholics, various other Protestant denominations, many of them can trace their own Christian heritage back to the 19th century, the British Raj, when the Brits, though Protestant empire, allowed Catholic missionary activity all over the subcontinent. So Franciscans, Augustinians, all manner of Catholic missionaries converted many of the South Asians who were Muslims or of the lower classes of Hinduism. And those people continue to live there. It's a small percentage of the population, a couple million people, most of them in the big cities like Karachi and Lahore. So they are technically able to practice their faith openly. There are big churches and cathedrals. There's a number of bishops there. But there's all kinds of soft and hard forms of coercion levered against them by both the Pakistani government and Muslim extremists who would prefer that their land be purified of Christians. So it's very difficult for new churches to be built. Churches are frequently attacked, sometimes bombed. Many Christians have been killed during these attacks. So it is definitely a very dangerous country for Christians to live in.
Well, my guest today, Casey Chalk. We'll take a few of your calls, too. I know Ed, who's listening to us in Fontana, California, is from Jordan. Knows a lot of Christians who have lost everything. We'll hear from him when we return. If you want to join us, share your experiences, join the conversation, ask your questions, I'll open the phones at 888-914-9149. Taking a look today at The Persecuted. It's a new book out by my guest, and also just taking a look at a reality that you and I, pray to God, never know. All right, stay with me. I'll be back. We'll talk more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
Every day, live. Of course, anything you miss, you can join me in cyberspace. Go to the podcast and check out a conversation or maybe share it with others. It's good to be with you, though. I only have a few minutes left today, and I do want to jump into the phones. I'll take a few of your calls. If you're just joining me, we're taking a look at true stories of courageous Christians living their faith in Muslim lands. There's a new book out by a guy named Casey Chalk. It's called The Persecuted. Do a quick search for it. And it's an eye-opener. You know, for the past, two millennia now, if you think about it, Christians have been persecuted. And it takes place wherever the church is present, especially in every corner of the world. There's no place really that's immune. 260 million Christians around the globe. 260 million are facing some form of persecution right now, and that number continues to climb. Think about our country. We're what? We're 300 million plus, right? 260 million. That's like the entire country here. Think about that, almost. Around the globe facing persecution. So the book really is, it tells these real-life stories of brave Christians who have suffered everything from intimidation to oppression to violence to being sold into marriage and all sorts of other things. So check it out, and I want to welcome back Casey. Casey, thanks for writing. We'll jump right into the phones, too, and take a few calls for you. I'm looking forward to hearing from Ed. He's in Fontana, California, and he's actually from Jordan. He's got a story to share. Ed, good afternoon.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Hey, well, thank you. Thank you, Drew. I've been following you, and thank you for the work you do, you and Relevant Radio.
Thank you.
Drew, I am... I am from Jordan, but I know lots of Christians. They are friends and some of them relatives who are from Syria and Iraq. And just before I get to my point, I just want to say something. Also, there is another book. It's called The Disappearing People by Stephen Rash. And it's really very powerful book about his eyewitness to the persecution and to the decimation of Christianity in Iraq and in the in Erbil and North Iraq and Syria. Yeah. The point I would like to, you know, also, by the way, in, a few days ago, you mentioned something about the author who wrote a book, Left to Tell. That is yes. also another another powerful book about real life touching real people. The yeah, point I want to make is this, Drew. How come it's becoming unfashionable to help fellow Christians? How come when Christians are persecuted, it's like we became numb? How come when let's say, Muslims are persecuted, let's say in China or that region, yep. and the whole world gets up in arms and try to help them out. But the Christians, somehow we became numb. Let me take this step further, if I may. Sure. Am I in the air? Am I with you? You with me?
No, you're here. No, go right ahead, Ed. I'm listening.
Okay. Now, the Christians, they were persecuted by ISIS. In Iraq and in Syria. Once Iraq was done with, okay, the Christians, some of the Christians came back, but also to be persecuted by the Kurds who tried to take their homes.
Yeah.
Once that settled, they were also persecuted by the Persian Iranian militia. It's called Hashd al-Shaabi. So, I remember at that time, our Vice President Pence, he promised that some money will go directly to the mm-hmm. To the people affected, which never took place, according to Stephen Rash in his book, The Disappearing People. The point I want to make, how come we get to this point? There is more Christians persecuted in the 21st century than any other time.
Yeah, it's such a good point. Ed, let's talk about this, and we'll bring Casey into the conversation as well. And that's such it's often a surprising statistic for a lot of people, Casey, that more people are being persecuted in this modern day than at any other time. And it's so true. I know that Ed is from Jordan, and he's known a lot of Christians who've lost everything. I've known people in Erbil and other areas as well. And I know that you have chronicled stories of Christians who've escaped Muslim persecution and who've slipped away, who were trapped everywhere from Russia, who've been, in some instances, tortured and even killed. Your thoughts? I mean, I disagree with one point that Ed brought. I mean, it's not that the world is up in arms over what's happening in China. I think more needs to be done with the Uyghurs. I think too little is being done with those Muslims who are being persecuted and put in concentration camps there. But to Ed, your point, I would agree. There seems to be a deafness, a blindness, an apathy when it comes to Christians being persecuted from every place, from the Holy Land to Pakistan and Afghanistan and around the world. So, Casey, let me throw that to you. I'd love some of your analysis, and I'd also like to know what we as individuals can do, because so often people feel out of sight, out of mind. What can I do to help those who are in these situations?
Sure. So I think to the first question, I think some of the answer probably has to do with the decline in religiosity and particularly Christian practice in the West. True. The less that people are Christian and are going to churches where they can hear these stories and even care about people who are Christians in other parts of the world, the less they're going to be, you know, interested or willing to stand up for those who are suffering. I think also just a general ignorance. Western media does not report on these stories as much as they used to. So I think that certainly hurts us. That's something that I talk a lot about in The Persecuted. Just to give one example, a number of the stories that I've written about were briefed to a congressional subcommittee hearing a couple years ago. And on that subcommittee was Ilhan Omar, a prominent Muslim politician from Michigan.
Sure.
And even though the focus of the briefing was on the plight of suffering Christian communities, she tried to turn the conversation to talk more about Muslims who are being persecuted in the United States. I mean, there's really simply no comparison between those. Muslims are not Muslims are free to practice their faith openly in the United States. There is no state-sanctioned persecution. Only the most extreme, isolated incidents can be found in the United States of Muslims suffering anything. But whereas Christianity, as we've talked about, we're talking about millions of people across dozens of countries. So there's just no comparison.
Yeah. Well, Ed, I want to thank you for calling and
can
for
I
sharing
add something,
as well. Yes, very quickly.
Can I add, Drew? Can I a quick one? Just to give you briefly, in Iraq before the war, there was more than 1.5 million Christians in Iraq alone. Right now, if you do a stat according to the Archbishop of Erbil, there is hardly 150,000 people in Iraq. So really, we are witnessing the disappearance of a civilization, one of the oldest civilizations in Syria and Iraq. And thank you very much for taking my call.
I'm grateful for your call. Thank you very much, Ed. And Casey, I'm going to give you final thoughts here, too. I mean, again, I know people will hear this. They'll think it's horrible. But we do need to take action. We need to do our part. I mean, Persecuted, your book, great read for people who want to understand what's happening here. Are there agencies you'd recommend support to, or what else would you recommend? And some final thoughts as we wrap it up.
Yeah, of course. So three things I would suggest to listeners. The first is pray. Pray because prayer works. I saw it in my own life and the life of many of the persecuted Pakistani Christians that I met over the last several years. Also because it aligns our hearts with those of our Lord, who can be present with them and help us to deepen our own sense of union with the persecuted church around the world. Secondly, yes, there are plenty of organizations that people can give to. I'll just name three quickly. The Knights of Columbus has a particular focus on helping persecuted Christians on their website, as does the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And then thirdly, there's even a really great Protestant organization called the Barnabas Fund that does something similar to my book, where it provides lots of stories. People can give money, and they can give money to actual individual families, churches, communities, so they know exactly where their money is going and get updates about what's happening. And then thirdly, I would encourage people to contact their local representatives and local media and say that you care about this. Buy my book, send it to your local politician. Tell them that this is something you want to hear them, you want to see them take action on and respond to. I think those are three immediate steps that listeners can take to help the suffering of the persecuted church around the world.
Well, I'm grateful for your time. Just a side note, because I only have about a minute left. I've heard about accounts in various Muslim nations where people are having dreams of Jesus or even visions of the Lord coming to them, and there's been mass conversion to Christianity. Have you heard any of those reports?
Oh, yeah. I have heard about a number of those reports, and actually in the Persecuted, in my book, I talk about a particular story where one of the Pakistanis I knew who was detained by the Thais for overstaying his visa basically was able to persuade an entire cell full of many Muslims to pray the rosary with him Lord willing, have some conversions. So these stories are happening.
That's awesome. Hey, Casey, keep up your good work, all right? I'm grateful for it. You're making a difference. But I'm out of time for the day, so we'll leave it there. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me on your program, Drew.
You got it. That's Casey Chalk. And again, the book, Persecuted, True Stories of Courageous Christian Living. Persecuted, True Stories of Courageous Christians Living Their Faith in Muslim Lands. Do yourself a favor. Read it. Look, I'm out of time for the day. I'll be back again tomorrow. Cale Clark is coming right up, so stay tuned for him. Until our paths again cross, I'll be praying for you. I promise. Please say a prayer for me. Remember, God loves you. Have a great day.